Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our weekly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien and joining me today is Semantic Threat Researcher Candid West. In this week's podcast, we'll be talking about the latest news surrounding the ransomware attack against the US city of Baltimore, the fallout from the discovery of the Bluekeep or DP vulnerability, how an Australian teenager twice hacked Apple in a bid to get a job offer, and the latest in a long line of Bitcoin scams. But first, London's Underground Service announced this week that they wanted to start tracking users in order to reduce waiting times. Candid, what does this mean for people using the tube in the future?
Yeah, so the operator of the London Underground has announced that they will start collecting Wi-Fi connection data from their free Wi-Fi access in the tube starting from July 8 this year. So those who haven't been in London for a while might not know it, but the London Underground system actually offers free wireless access in about 97% of its location, which totally makes sense as there is, of course, no mobile phone reception below the surface as it's down in the tunnels. And judging from all the people staring at their phones in the morning, at least the last time I was there, indicates clearly to me that quite a few people might be using that service. And the idea behind the new push is clear. The Travel for London company wants to better understand the customer flow and kind of measure how long it takes for people to move from one side of the station to the other. And then they want to use that data to issue better alerts about delays, congestions, and so on to the customers. In order to achieve this, they will start collecting Wi-Fi connection data inside their stations. And now you might say, if you don't have signed up for their underground free Wi-Fi service, but still enabled Wi-Fi on your phone for whatever reason, then your phone will actually periodically send out some kind of a beacon to see if any of its preferred networks are nearby. And those probing packets contain the network MAC address of your device, which can then be recorded by the access point.
Okay. Now, I thought it's quite a reasonable reason that Transport for London wants to introduce this, but are they aware that privacy these days is quite a sensitive topic?
Of course they are, and the Travel for London promised that the data is automatically depersonalized, so using a one-way function, which I assume they just hash it and then discard the original string value right away, which makes sense. They also said that for now they will not proceed or process any of these unauthenticated beacons. So if you do not connect to their free Wi-Fi service, then your packets will be discarded and not be used for this analysis. Which again makes sense, as it actually would be quite difficult anyway, as since 2014, all iPhones can randomize their Wi-Fi MAC addresses, and shortly after, Android implemented the same feature in their phones. So hence, it is quite difficult to track someone just based on the beacon MAC address alone. But if you do use their free Wi-Fi service, then they will be able to track you. And of course, you have to accept their usage policy when you sign up, so that should give you some information around it. And don't worry, they are not logging your browser history or anything else you do, or the name of your device and so on. So they are aware that privacy is a hot topic and they try to log as little as possible for their analysis. And there are information posters in all tube stations. Well, at least if you pay attention and start to read them. So if you do not want to be tracked and, well, you have a few options. You can, of course, switch off the Wi-Fi or put your phone into airplane mode altogether, which on the other hand means you won't be able to receive any of those funny text messages, so you might have to talk to your friends instead. Which is not a bad idea anyway, but except that last time I was there, people enjoyed the silence on the morning trains, I'd say.
Yeah, that's right. Now, this actually reminds me of a piece of research you did, I think it was around 5 years ago, about fitness trackers. Is this kind of similar?
Yes, it is indeed. So in 2014, we did an experiment around the whole quantified self trend. So that was when lots of people started using fitness tracker bracelets and mobile phone applications to record every movement of their life. So most of these devices use Bluetooth low energy to communicate to the smartphone nearby, in order to send their accumulated data like steps taken or heart rate and any of the other data. And we kind of similar to the Wi-Fi, we thought, well, Bluetooth MAC addresses can be tracked easily as they were, at least at the time, not randomized either. So we built some small Raspberry Pi Bluetooth scanner with the battery pack and then checked at some sporting events like a city marathon if we would be able to actually track people. And of course, it worked like the charm. Same principle as on the tube. And for us, as most of their phones were actually broadcasting a unique name, like Candid's iPhone, you could even put a first name on most of the fitness trackers that we saw. But I guess it shouldn't really come as a surprise that wireless device tracking has been used in many places for quite a substantial time. I have seen it used in airports, malls, at festivals, and of course, it is also very, very popular with different advertisement industry because they love to track people as well. So I guess if you feel uncomfortable about it, it's best to turn off any communication, so like Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, if you do not need them, which also saves you some battery life. So now let's move on to our next item. Dick, I remember a couple of weeks ago, you discussed the ransomware attack against the US city of Baltimore, right? And I understand there has been some more news about the attack.
Yeah, there has been. So just to recap first, the attack was the second such incident affecting Baltimore in a little over a year. And this latest attack, which occurred about 3 weeks ago at this stage, forced a lot of the city's systems offline. And even computers that weren't infected were taken offline lest the infection spread to them. So the bad news for Baltimore is that the city is still struggling to recover from the attack, so much so that they're requesting the attack be designated a disaster, and they're asking for federal assistance to finance the cleanup operation.
Wow. Do we know anything more about the ransomware that's been used in that attack?
Yes, there's actually been a flurry of media reports over the past few days, and they've added lots of extra detail to what we know about the attack. So the first thing to note is that the malware used in the attack is now understood to be a relatively new type of ransomware that's called Robinhood, that's with two Bs, and Symantec detects it as ransom.robinhood. It appears to work in similar fashion to other targeted ransomware families. So that means it's spread across a network before simultaneously encrypting multiple computers. And then the attackers offer to either decrypt single computers for a set fee or alternatively decrypt all the infected computers for a slightly larger fee. Now, I understand the ransom demand issued to Baltimore reportedly ran to $100,000 and the city has refused to pay. So, according to a report this week in Ars Technica, the city appeared to be quite unprepared for a cyber attack of this scale. They said that since 2012, four Baltimore City chief information officers have either been fired or have resigned, with two of them leaving while they were under investigation. And in 2018, last year, Baltimore only allocated 2.5% of the city's budget for information technology services. So to put that in context, that's less than half the average for most US cities. And in 2017, the city's current CIO reported that many of the city's IT capabilities were, quote, outdated and lacked the modern day range of capabilities offered by comparable cities. He blamed this on, another quote, decades of decentralized information technology management and insufficient enterprise investment.
Yes, and I believe that the Eternal Blue exploit was used by the attackers, correct?
That's right, yeah. In a further interesting development, the New York Times has reported this week that the infamous Eternal Blue exploit was used to spread Robinhood across Baltimore's network. So to recap about Eternal Blue, for those of you who may not be familiar with it, it was one of the huge cache of tools belonging to the Equation Cyber Espionage Group that were leaked by a group known as the Shadow Brokers back in 2017. Now, Eternal Blue sprang to public attention when a few months after that, it was used to devastating effect in the WannaCry ransomware outbreak that was in May 2017. So given the fact that the vulnerabilities exploited by Eternal Blue were patched by Microsoft more than 2 years ago, its use in this attack kind of suggests that many of Baltimore's computers were running unpatched versions of Windows. Now, the New York Times said the attack raises some serious questions for governments, and that's because the Equation Group is widely understood to be a state-sponsored espionage group, and hoarding vulnerabilities and incorporating them into your tools raises some interesting questions about the ethics and the wisdom of these practices, because as what happened to the Equation, there's a chance that these tools may fall into the wrong hands. And the worst case scenario, of course, is a nation state developing tools that are subsequently stolen and leaked and used against that country's government or citizens. So the Times story was written by Nicole Perroth and Scott Shane, who also, as it happened, reported on our own recently published research on the BookEye Group, where we found that they were using Equation Group tools prior to the Shadow Brokers leak. That meant that there were on at least two occasions in which Equation Group tools fell into the wrong hands. In that report, they also raised the question of whether countries should be hoarding exploits in this fashion. And they actually quoted our colleague Eric Chen, who summed it up by saying, "We've learned that you cannot guarantee your tools will not get leaked and used against you and your allies." So it's a really interesting and a really serious issue, obviously. And I think the more attacks we see involving leaked exploits, the more pressure governments may come under to rethink their policies. Now, Candid, another important topic, this RDP vulnerability, which has been named Bluekeep, is still keeping us quite busy. You have some updates on this one, don't you?
Yeah, so we have talked about the remote exploitable RDP vulnerability on this podcast before, as it was described by Microsoft as a wormable, with, of course, a hint to the recent WannaCry outbreak. Many security people kept an eye out looking for any activity around remote desktop protocol. Even though patches are available, history has shown us that not all systems are getting patched. And a few researchers have created proof of concept exploits to test it, but none of them is publicly released, at least yet. But there are a few test scripts available that can be used to check for vulnerable systems, even including a Metasploit scan module, which is available now. So, of course, exposed RDP servers have always been kind of an interesting topic for attackers, as many of them have weak passwords that can easily be brute forced. For example, in May, so this month, our friends at Binary Edge had found over 2.7 million exposed RDP servers while scanning the whole internet. And last week, on May 22nd, we saw the activity kind of spiking up, and it looks like someone is using a scanner tool, maybe even the Metasploit module, to scan for vulnerable servers. Some of the IP addresses scanned for thousands and ten thousands of targets. Some masqueraded their origin behind the Tor network, just to kind of obfuscate it a little bit more. And then the activity even doubled at the beginning of this week. So there is something coming. But the question now is it either someone who's trying to check how many people have installed the patches for research purposes, or is it an attacker creating maybe a list of vulnerable servers? The good news is, so far, we still have not seen any exploiting in the wild. But I guess everyone is anticipating that, and it could start any day now. And this is probably also the reason why, for example, the Siemens Medical Technology Vision released patches for six of their own products last week against this RDP vulnerability. And this includes stuff like medical screening and mobile X-ray products. And of course, those non-classical IT systems are very often forgotten and frequently fall victim to those worm outbreaks.
Yeah, indeed. Potentially vulnerable systems can be found in any location, really. So we're going to keep an eye out for any outbreaks that might come.
Yeah, we definitely will. But now let's turn to Australia, because there was a report this week that a teenage boy was found guilty of hacking Apple, but managed to escape the jail.
Yes, a 17-year-old boy was up in court in Adelaide, where he pleaded guilty to multiple charges relating to two separate attacks against Apple. The first one occurred in 2015 when he was just 13 years old. And then he attacked the company again in 2015 when he was only 15, this time with an accomplice. And going by the media reports, at least, the attack seems to have been quite serious because they apparently managed to create false credentials, which then allowed them to log on to the company's network, posing as company employees, and download internal documents.
Wow. Do we have any idea of why he was trying to hack into Apple?
Well, it seems like he was actually looking for a job. The idea being that the company may have been so impressed by his skills that they'd ask him to come and work for them. And although it's never advisable, it's actually a bit less outlandish than it may sound because, as his lawyer pointed out, this has happened in the past. And he mentioned a case in Europe when a hacker was subsequently offered a job by the company he attacked. His lawyer also pointed to the defendant's age, saying that it meant that he might have no idea about the gravity of the offence.
Do we know how he was caught?
Yes. It seems that Apple reported the intrusions to the FBI, who mounted an investigation and traced the attacks back to Australia. And they then passed that information on to the Australian Federal Police, which presumably resulted them in knocking on his door and having a somewhat awkward conversation with the boy's parents.
Yeah, that definitely would have been an awkward conversation, I guess. So how did the judge react in the end to the boy's guilty plea?
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, he's been spared jail, which I suppose, given the circumstances and the boy's age, isn't very surprising. He did impose a $500 fine. That's Australian dollars, which I think translates around $350 US, and placed him on a 9-month good behavior bond. So he didn't get off scot-free. The judge also used a kind of a superhero movie line when he urged the boy to use your gifts for good rather than for evil. So let's hope that that's a lesson learned. Now, we'll turn to our final item because there is a site promising free bitcoins, which has turned out to be a scam. Not very surprising, I guess. Candid, what's this news from the world of Bitcoin?
Yeah, so with Bitcoin rising and even scratching at the $9,000 mark this week, it is clear that there is still some interest in cryptocurrencies, which of course also means that attackers are also still interested in the space because there are profits to be made, right? And crypto coin mining, the activity which was massive at the end of 2017 and the beginning of 2018, has dropped massively last year, but we still saw around 2.5 million detections in May alone. So it's not gone, and neither are the classical scams around cryptocurrencies, like the one you just mentioned. This one is a service advertising to give away $15 to $45 per day. All you have to do is run their Bitcoin collecting software. So the tool was not even a crypto mining malware, as you might think, but just a simple dropper for any other malware. So in some instances, it downloaded a ransomware, which would then encrypt your files. In other cases, a password stealer was installed, stealing all your passwords and credit cards and so on. All cases have something in common. At the end, the user did not get anything paid out. So it's a classical scam where the criminals promise some reward if the user runs their software. And of course, if you refer your friends to it, you would even get more payout according to the scammers. We have seen many, many variations of this scam. In short, we can say there is no free money. So be very skeptical if someone offers you a huge reward for doing nothing, especially if they just ask you for lots of sensitive information or ask you to install an unknown software.
Yeah, it sounds like one of those real classic get-rich schemes.
Yes, it does. And unfortunately, some people still fall for them. So watch out for those. And I guess the anonymity of cryptocurrencies make it even more appealing for the cyber criminals, as the risk of getting caught is quite low. Even though Bitcoin is anonymous, the transactions themselves are public and of course can be traced, which is why many cybercriminals are using so-called mixing services. So mixing or washing means that the user transfers some amount of Bitcoins to a service, and the amount is then split up in hundreds of smaller parts, and they are mixed with coins from other users, and then you get repaid from a different account. And of course, this kind of mix-up makes it very unlikely or even impossible to track which coins belong to who exactly, generating kind of more or less clean coins afterwards. And last week, Europol, together with law enforcement from the Netherlands and Luxembourg, seized six servers belonging to a mixing service called BestMixer.io. The operator offered apparently mixing services for Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, and Litecoin, and laundered approximately $200 million worth in crypto coins. So some of them were connected to illegal activity, which of course kind of started the interest of the law enforcement investigation. The police is now analyzing the gathered log files, and who knows, we might see further takedowns down in the future.
Okay. All right. That's all we have time for this week. If you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all the action in the future. You can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel or Medium at medium.com/threat-intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, check out our blog, which can be found at semantic.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again next week when we'll be once again discussing what's new in the world of cybersecurity. Until then, thank you and goodbye.